A Coup in the Rhineland. In his Reichstag peace speech of May 21, 1935, which, as we have seen, had so impressed the world and, above all, Great Britain, Hitler had mentioned that an element of legal insecurity had been brought into the Locarno Pact as a result of the Mutual Assistance Pact which had been signed between Russia and France on March 2 in Paris and on March 14 in Moscow, but which up to the end of the year had not been ratified by the French Parliament. The German Foreign Office called this element to the attention of Paris in a formal note to the French government. On November 21, François Poncet, the French ambassador, had a talk with Hitler in which the Führer launched into a long tirade against the Franco-Soviet pact. François Poncet reported to Paris he was convinced that Hitler intended to use the pact as an excuse to occupy the demilitarized zone of the Rhineland. Hitler's sole hesitancy, he added, is now concerned with the appropriate moment to act. François Poncet, probably the best-informed ambassador in Berlin, knew what he was talking about, though he was undoubtedly unaware that as early as the previous spring, on May 2nd, 19 days before Hitler's assurances in the Reichstag that he would respect the Locarno Pact and the territorial clauses of Versailles, General von Blomberg had issued his first directive to the three armed services to prepare plans for the reoccupation of the demilitarized Rhineland. The codename Schulung was given to the operation. It was to be executed by a surprise blow at lightning speed, and its planning was to be so secret that only the very smallest number of officers should be informed. In fact, in the interests of secrecy, Blomberg wrote out the order in handwriting. On June 16th, further discussion of the move into the Rhineland took place at the 10th meeting of the Working Committee of the Reich Defense Council, during which a Colonel Alfred Jodl, who had just become head of the Home Defense Department, reported on the plans and emphasized the need for the strictest secrecy. Nothing should be committed to writing that was not absolutely necessary, he warned, and he added that, without exception, such material must be kept in safes. All through the winter of 1935-36, Hitler bided his time. France and Britain, he could not help but note, were preoccupied with stopping Italy's aggression in Abyssinia, but Mussolini seemed to be getting by with it. Despite its much-publicized sanctions, the League of Nations was proving itself impotent to halt a determined aggressor. In Paris, the French Parliament seemed to be in no hurry to ratify the pact with the Soviet Union. The growing sentiment in the right was all against it. Apparently, Hitler thought there was a good chance of the French Chamber or Senate rejecting the alliance with Moscow. In that case, he would have to look for another excuse for Schulung. But the pact came before the Chamber on February 11th, and it was approved on the 27th by a vote of 353-164. 2 days later, on March 1st, Hitler reached his decision, somewhat to the consternation of the generals, most of whom were convinced that the French would make mincemeat of the small German forces which had been gathered for the move into the Rhineland. Nevertheless, on the next day, March 2nd, 1936, in obedience to his master's instructions, Blomberg issued formal orders for the occupation of the Rhineland. It was, he told the senior commanders of the armed forces, to be a surprise move. Blomberg expected it to be a peaceful operation. If it turned out that it was not, that is, that the French would fight, the commander-in-chief reserved the right to decide on any military countermeasures. Actually, as I learned 6 days later, and as would be confirmed from the testimony of the generals at Nuremberg, Blomberg already had in mind what those countermeasures would be, a hasty retreat back over the Rhine. But the French, their nation already paralyzed by internal strife and the people sinking into defeatism, did not know this when a small token force of German troops paraded across the Rhine bridges at dawn on March 7th and entered the demilitarized zone. According to Jodl's testimony at Nuremberg, only three battalions crossed the Rhine, making for Aachen, Trier, and Saarbrücken, and only one division was employed in the occupation of the entire territory. Allied intelligence estimates were considerably larger, 35,000 men, or approximately three divisions. Hitler commented later, "The fact was, I had only four brigades." At 10 a.m., Neurath, the compliant foreign minister, called in the ambassadors of France, Britain, and Italy, apprised them of the news from the Rhineland, and handed them a formal note denouncing the Locarno Treaty, which Hitler had just broken, and proposing new plans for peace. Hitler struck his adversary in the face, François Poncet wryly observed, and as he did so, he declared, "I bring you proposals for peace." Indeed, 2 hours later, the Führer was standing at the rostrum of the Reichstag before a delirious audience, expounding on his desire for peace and his latest ideas of how to maintain it. I went over to the Kroll Opera House to see the spectacle, which I shall never forget, for it was both fascinating and gruesome. After a long harangue about the evils of Versailles and the threat of Bolshevism, Hitler calmly announced that France's pact with Russia had invalidated the Locarno Treaty, which, unlike that of Versailles, Germany had freely signed. The scene that followed, I noted down in my diary that evening. "Germany no longer feels bound by the Locarno Treaty," Hitler said. "In the interest of the primitive rights of its people to the security of their frontier and the safeguarding of their defense, the German government has re-established, as from today, the absolute and unrestricted sovereignty of the Reich in the demilitarized zone." Now the 600 deputies, personal appointees all of Hitler, little men with big bodies and bulging necks and cropped hair and pouched bellies and brown uniforms and heavy boots, leaped to their feet like automatons, their right arms upstretched in the Nazi salute, and scream "Heils!" Hitler raises his hand for silence. He says in a deep, resonant voice, "Men of the German Reichstag!" The silence is utter. In this historic hour, when in the Reich's western provinces German troops are at this minute marching into their future peacetime garrisons, we all unite in 2 sacred vows. He can go no further. It is news to this parliamentary mob that German soldiers are already on the move into the Rhineland. All the militarism in their German blood surges to their heads. They spring, yelling and crying, to their feet. Their hands are raised in slavish salute, their eyes now contorted with hysteria, their mouths wide open, shouting, shouting, their eyes, burning with fanaticism, glued on the new god, the Messiah. The Messiah plays his role superbly. His head lowered, as if in all humbleness, he waits patiently for silence. Then his voice, still low but choking with emotion, utters the 2 vows. "First, we swear to yield to no force whatever in restoration of the honor of our people. Secondly, we pledge that now, more than ever, we shall strive for an understanding between the European peoples, especially for one with our Western neighbor nations. We have no territorial demands to make in Europe. Germany will never break the peace." It was a long time before the cheering stopped. A few generals made their way out. Behind their smiles, however, you could not help detecting a nervousness. I ran into General von Blomberg. His face was white, his cheeks twitching. And with reason. The Minister of Defense, who 5 days before had issued in his own handwriting the order to march, was losing his nerve. The next day I learned that he had given orders for his troops to withdraw across the Rhine should the French move to oppose them. But the French never made the slightest move. François Poncet says that after his warning of the previous November, the French High Command had asked the government what it would do in case the ambassador proved right. The answer was, he says, that the government would take the matter up with the League of Nations. Actually, when the blow occurred, it was the French government which wanted to act and the French General Staff which held back. Despite François Poncet's warning of the previous fall, Germany's action apparently came as a complete surprise to the French and British governments and their General Staffs. General Gamelin, François Poncet declares, advised that a war operation, however limited, entailed unpredictable risks and could not be undertaken without decreeing a general mobilization. The most General Gamelin, the chief of the General Staff, would do, and did, was concentrate 13 divisions near the German frontier, but merely to reinforce the Maginot Line. Even this was enough to throw a scare into the German high command. Blomberg, backed by Jodl and most of the officers at the top, wanted to pull back the 3 battalions that had crossed the Rhine. As Jodl testified at Nuremberg, "Considering the situation we were in, the French covering army could have blown us to pieces." It could have, and had it, that almost certainly would have been the end of Hitler, after which history might have taken quite a different and brighter turn than it did, for the dictator could never have survived such a fiasco. Hitler himself admitted as much. A retreat on our part, he conceded later, would have spelled collapse. It was Hitler's iron nerves alone which now, as during many crises that lay ahead, saved the situation and, confounding the reluctant generals, brought success. But it was no easy moment for him. The 48 hours after the march into the Rhineland, Paul Schmidt, his interpreter, heard him later say, were the most nerve-wracking in my life. If the French had then marched into the Rhineland, we would have had to withdraw with our tails between our legs, for the military resources at our disposal would have been wholly inadequate for even a moderate resistance. Confident that the French would not march, he bluntly turned down all suggestions for pulling back by the wavering high command. General Beck, chief of the general staff, wanted the Führer to at least soften the blow by proclaiming that he would not fortify the area west of the Rhine, a suggestion, Jodl later testified, which the Führer turned down very bluntly, for obvious reasons, as we shall see. Blomberg's proposal to withdraw, Hitler later told General von Rundstedt, was nothing less than an act of cowardice. What would have happened, Hitler exclaimed in a bull session with his cronies at headquarters on the evening of March 27, 1942, in recalling the Rhineland coup, if anybody other than myself had been at the head of the Reich? Anyone you care to mention would have lost his nerve. I was obliged to lie, and what saved us was my unshakable obstinacy and my amazing aplomb. It was true, but it must also be recorded that he was aided not only by the hesitations of the French, but by the supineness of their British allies. The French Foreign Minister, Pierre-Étienne Flandin, flew to London on March 11th and begged the British government to back France in a military counteraction in the Rhineland. His pleas were unavailing. Britain would not risk war, even though Allied superiority over the Germans was overwhelming. As Lord Lothian remarked, the Germans, after all, are only going into their own back garden. Even before the French arrived in London, Anthony Eden, who had become Foreign Secretary in the previous December, had told the House of Commons on March 9th, "Occupation of the Rhineland by the Reichswehr deals a heavy blow to the principle of the sanctity of treaties. Fortunately," he added, "we have no reason to suppose that Germany's present action threatens hostilities." And yet, France was entitled, under the terms of the Locarno Treaty, to take military action against the presence of German troops in the demilitarized zone, and Britain was obligated by that treaty to back her with her own armed forces. The abortive London conversations were a confirmation to Hitler that he had gotten away with his latest gamble. The British not only shied away from the risk of war, but once again they took seriously the latest installment of Hitler's peace proposals. In the notes handed to the three ambassadors on March 7th and in his speech to the Reichstag, Hitler had offered to sign a 25-year non-aggression pact with Belgium and France, to be guaranteed by Britain and Italy, to conclude similar non-aggression pacts with Germany's neighbors on the east, to agree to the demilitarization of both sides of the Franco-German frontier, and finally to return to the League of Nations. Hitler's sincerity might have been judged by his proposal to demilitarize both sides of the Franco-German border, since it would have forced France to scrap her Maginot Line, her last protection against a surprise German attack. In London, the esteemed Times, while deploring Hitler's precipitate action in invading the Rhineland, headed its leading editorial, "A Chance to Rebuild." In retrospect, it is easy to see that Hitler's successful gamble in the Rhineland brought him a victory more staggering and more fatal in its immense consequences than could be comprehended at the time. At home, it fortified his popularity and his power, raising them to heights which no German ruler of the past had ever enjoyed. On March 7th, Hitler had dissolved the Reichstag and called for a new election and a referendum on his move into the Rhineland. According to the official figures of the voting on March 29th, some 99% of the 45,453,691 registered voters went to the polls, and 98.8% of them approved Hitler's action. Foreign correspondents who visited the polling places found some irregularities, especially open instead of secret voting, and there was no doubt that some Germans feared, with justification as we have seen, that a 9 vote might be discovered by the Gestapo. Dr. Hugo Eckener told this writer that on his new Zeppelin Hindenburg, which Goebbels had ordered to cruise over German cities as a publicity stunt, the Ja vote, which was announced by the propaganda minister as 42, outnumbered the total number of persons aboard by 2. Nevertheless, this observer, who covered the election from one corner of the Reich to the other, has no doubt that the vote of approval for Hitler's coup was overwhelming. And why not? The junking of Versailles and the appearance of German soldiers marching again into what was, after all, German territory, were things that almost all Germans naturally approved. The no vote was given as 540,211. It assured his ascendancy over his generals, who had hesitated and weakened at a moment of crisis when he had held firm. It taught them that in foreign politics and even in military affairs, his judgment was superior to theirs. They had feared that the French would fight. He knew better. And finally, and above all, the Rhineland occupation, small as it was as a military operation, opened the way as only Hitler, and Churchill alone in England, seemed to realize, to vast new opportunities in a Europe which was not only shaken, but whose strategic situation was irrevocably changed by the parading of 3 German battalions across the Rhine bridges. Conversely, it is equally easy to see in retrospect that France's failure to repel the Wehrmacht battalions and Britain's failure to back her in what would have been nothing more than a police action was a disaster for the West, from which sprang all the later ones of even greater magnitude. In March 1936, the 2 Western democracies were given their last chance to halt, without the risk of a serious war, the rise of a militarized, aggressive, totalitarian Germany, and, in fact, as we have seen Hitler admitting, bring the Nazi dictator and his regime tumbling down. They let the chance slip by. For France, it was the beginning of the end. Her allies in the East, Russia, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia, suddenly were faced with the fact that France would not fight against German aggression to preserve the security system which the French government itself had taken the lead in so laboriously building up. But more than that, these Eastern allies began to realize that even if France were not so supine, she would soon not be able to lend them much assistance because of Germany's feverish construction of a west wall behind the Franco-German border. The erection of this fortress line, they saw, would quickly change the strategic map of Europe, to their detriment. They could scarcely expect a France which did not dare, with her 100 divisions, to repel 3 German battalions, to bleed her young manhood against impregnable German fortifications while the Wehrmacht attacked in the east. But even if the unexpected took place, it would be futile. Henceforth, the French could tie down in the west only a small part of the growing German army. The rest would be free for operations against Germany's eastern neighbors. The value of the Rhineland fortifications to Hitler's strategy was conveyed to William C. Bullitt, the American ambassador to France, when he called on the German foreign minister in Berlin on May 18, 1936. Von Neurath said, Bullitt reported to the State Department, that it was the policy of the German government to do nothing active in foreign affairs until the Rhineland had been digested. He explained that he meant that until the German fortifications had been constructed on the French and Belgian frontiers, the German government would do everything possible to prevent rather than encourage an outbreak by the Nazis in Austria, and would pursue a quiet line with regard to Czechoslovakia. As soon as our fortifications are constructed and the countries of Central Europe realize that France cannot enter German territory at will, all those countries will begin to feel very differently about their foreign policies, and a new constellation will develop, he said. This development now began. As I stood at the grave of my predecessor, the murdered Dollfuss, Dr. Schuschnigg related in his memoirs, I knew that in order to save Austrian independence, I had to embark on a course of appeasement. Everything had to be avoided which could give Germany a pretext for intervention, and everything had to be done to secure in some way Hitler's toleration of the status quo. The new and youthful Austrian chancellor had been encouraged by Hitler's public declaration to the Reichstag on May 21, 1935, that Germany neither intends nor wishes to interfere in the internal affairs of Austria, to annex Austria, or to conclude an Anschluss. and he had been reassured by the reiteration at Stresa by Italy, France, and Britain of their determination to help safeguard Austria's independence. Then Mussolini, Austria's principal protector since 1933, had become bogged down in Abyssinia and had broken with France and Britain. When the Germans marched into the Rhineland and began to fortify it, Dr. Schuschnigg realized that some appeasement of Hitler was due. He began negotiating a new treaty with the wily German minister in Vienna, Papen, who, though the Nazis had come within an ace of murdering him during the June purge, had nevertheless gone to work on his arrival in Austria in the late summer of 1934, after the Nazi assassination of Dollfuss, to undermine Austria's independence and capture Hitler's native land for the leader. National socialism must and will overpower the new Austrian ideology, he had written Hitler on July 27, 1935, in giving an account of his first year of service in Vienna. In its published text, the Austro-German agreement signed on July 11, 1936, seemed to show an unusual amount of generosity and tolerance on the part of Hitler. Germany reaffirmed its recognition of Austria's sovereignty and the promise not to interfere in the internal affairs of its neighbor. In return, Austria pledged that in its foreign policy it would always act on the principle that it acknowledged itself to be a German state. But there were secret clauses in the treaty, and in them Schuschnigg made concessions which would lead him and his little country to their doom. He agreed secretly to amnesty Nazi political prisoners in Austria and to appoint representatives of the so-called national opposition, a euphemism for Nazis or Nazi sympathizers, to positions of political responsibility. This was equivalent to allowing Hitler to set up a Trojan horse in Austria. Into it would crawl shortly Zeiss Inquart, a Viennese lawyer who will cut a certain figure in the subsequent narrative. Although Papen had obtained Hitler's approval of the text of the treaty, making a personal visit to Berlin for the purpose early in July, the Führer was furious with his envoy when the latter telephoned him on July 16th to notify him that the agreement had been signed. "Hitler's reaction astonished me," Papen later wrote. "Instead of expressing his gratification, he broke into a flood of abuse. I had misled him," he said, "into making exaggerated concessions. The whole thing was a trap." As it turned out, it was a trap for Schuschnigg, not for Hitler. The signing of the Austro-German Treaty was a sign that Mussolini had lost his grip on Austria. It might have been expected that this would worsen the relations between the two fascist dictators, but just the opposite occurred, due to events which now, in 1936, played into Hitler's hands. On May 2, 1936, Italian forces entered the Abyssinian capital, Addis Ababa, and on July 4th, the League of Nations formally capitulated and called off its sanctions against Italy. 2 weeks later, on July 16th, Franco staged a military revolt in Spain and civil war broke out. Hitler, as was his custom at that time of year, was taking in the opera at the Wagner Festival at Bayreuth. On the night of July 22nd, after he had returned from the theater, a German businessman from Morocco, accompanied by the local Nazi leader, arrived in Bayreuth with an urgent letter from Franco. The rebel leader needed planes and other assistance. Hitler immediately summoned Göring and General von Blomberg, who happened to be in Bayreuth, and that very evening the decision was taken to give support to the Spanish rebellion. Though German aid to Franco never equaled that given by Italy, which dispatched between 60 and 70,000 troops, as well as vast supplies of arms and planes, it was considerable. The Germans estimated later that they spent €500 million on the venture, besides furnishing planes, tanks, technicians, and the Condor Legion, an Air Force unit which distinguished itself by the obliteration of the Spanish town of Guernica and its civilian inhabitants. Relative to Germany's own massive rearmament, it was not much, but it paid handsome dividends to Hitler. It gave France a third unfriendly fascist power on its borders. It exacerbated the internal strife in France between right and left, and thus weakened Germany's principal rival in the West. Above all, it rendered impossible a rapprochement of Britain and France with Italy, which the Paris and London governments had hoped for after the termination of the Abyssinian War, and thus drove Mussolini into the arms of Hitler. From the very beginning, the Führer's Spanish policy was shrewd, calculated, and far-seeing. A perusal of the captured German documents makes plain that one of Hitler's purposes was to prolong the Spanish Civil War in order to keep the Western democracies and Italy at loggerheads and draw Mussolini toward him. More than a year later, on November 5, 1937, Hitler would reiterate his Spanish policy in a confidential talk with his generals and his foreign minister. 100% victory for Franco, he told them, was not desirable from the German point of view. Rather, we are interested in a continuance of the war and in keeping up the tension in the Mediterranean. As early as December 1936, Ulrich von Hassel, the German ambassador in Rome, who had not yet achieved that recognition of Nazi aims and practices which he later obtained and which would cost him his life, was reporting to the Wilhelmstrasse. The role played by the Spanish conflict as regards Italy's relations with France and England could be similar to that of the Abyssinian conflict, bringing out clearly the actual opposing interests of the powers and thus preventing Italy from being drawn into the net of the Western powers and used for their machinations. The struggle for dominant political influence in Spain lays bare the natural opposition between Italy and France. At the same time, the position of Italy as a power in the Western Mediterranean comes into competition with that of Britain. All the more clearly will Italy recognize the advisability of confronting the Western powers shoulder to shoulder with Germany. It was these circumstances which gave birth to the Rome-Berlin Axis. On October 24th, after conferences with Neurath in Berlin, Count Galeazzo Ciano, Mussolini's son-in-law and foreign minister, made the first of his many pilgrimages to Berchtesgaden. He found the German dictator in a friendly and expansive mood. Mussolini, Hitler declared, was the leading statesman in the world, to whom none may even remotely compare himself. Together, Italy and Germany could conquer not only Bolshevism, but the West, including England. The British, Hitler thought, might eventually seek an accommodation with the united Italy and Germany. If not, the two powers, acting together, could easily dispose of her. German and Italian rearmament, Hitler reminded Ciano, is proceeding much more rapidly than rearmament can in England. In 3 years, Germany will be ready. The date is interesting. 3 years hence would be the fall of 1939. In Berlin on October 21st, Ciano and Neurath had signed a secret protocol which outlined a common policy for Germany and Italy in foreign affairs. In a speech at Milan a few days later, November 1st, Mussolini publicly referred to it without divulging the contents as an agreement which constituted an axis, around which the other European powers may work together. It would become a famous, and for the Duce, a fatal, word. With Mussolini in the bag, Hitler turned his attentions elsewhere. In August 1936, he had appointed Ribbentrop as German ambassador in London in an effort to explore the possibility of a settlement with England, on his own terms. Incompetent and lazy, vain as a peacock, arrogant and without humor, Ribbentrop was the worst possible choice for such a post, as Goering realized. "When I criticized Ribbentrop's qualifications to handle British problems," he later declared, "the Führer pointed out to me that Ribbentrop knew Lord so-and-so and Minister so-and-so, to which I replied, 'Yes, but the difficulty is that they know Ribbentrop.'" It is true that Ribbentrop, unattractive a figure though he was not without influential friends in London. Mrs. Simpson, the friend of the king, was believed in Berlin to be one of these. But Ribbentrop's initial efforts in his new post were discouraging, and in November he flew back to Berlin to conclude some non-British business he had been dabbling in. On November 25th, he signed the Anti-Comintern Pact with Japan, in which he told the correspondents, of whom this writer was one, without batting an eye, Germany and Japan had joined together to defend Western civilization. On the surface, this pact seemed to be nothing more than a propaganda trick by which Germany and Japan could win world support by exploiting the universal dislike for communism and the general distrust of the Comintern. But in this treaty, too, there was a secret protocol specifically directed against Russia. In case of an unprovoked attack by the Soviet Union against Germany or Japan, the two nations agreed to consult on what measures to take to safeguard their common interests, and also to take no measures which would tend to ease the situation of the Soviet Union. It was also agreed that neither nation would make any political treaties with Russia contrary to the spirit of the agreement without mutual consent. It would not be very long before Germany broke the agreement and accused Japan, unjustifiably, of not observing it. But the pact did serve a certain propaganda purpose among the world's gullible, and it brought together for the first time the three have-not and aggressor nations. Italy signed it the following year. On January 30, 1937, Hitler addressed the Reichstag, proclaiming the withdrawal of the German signature from the Versailles Treaty, an empty but typical gesture since the treaty was by now dead as a doornail, and reviewing with pride the record of his 4 years in office. He could be pardoned for his pride, for it was an impressive record in both domestic and foreign affairs. He had, as we have seen, abolished unemployment, created a boom in business, built up a powerful army, navy, and air force, provided them with considerable armaments and the promise of more on a massive scale. He had single-handedly broken the fetters of Versailles and bluffed his way into occupying the Rhineland. Completely isolated at first, he had found a loyal ally in Mussolini and another in Franco, and he had detached Poland from France. Most important of all, perhaps, he had released the dynamic energy of the German people, reawakening their confidence in the nation and their sense of its mission as a great and expanding world power. Everyone could see the contrast between this thriving, martial, boldly led new Germany and the decadent democracies in the West, whose confusions and vacillations seemed to increase with each new month of the calendar. Though they were alarmed, Britain and France had not lifted a finger to prevent Hitler from violating the peace treaty by rearming Germany and by reoccupying the Rhineland. They had been unable to stop Mussolini in Abyssinia. And now, as the year 1937 began, they were cutting a sorry figure by their futile gestures to prevent Germany and Italy from determining the outcome of the Spanish Civil War. Everyone knew what Italy and Germany were doing in Spain to assure Franco's victory. Yet the governments of London and Paris continued for years to engage in empty diplomatic negotiations with Berlin and Rome to assure non-intervention in Spain. It was a sport which seems to have amused the German dictator, and which certainly increased his contempt for the stumbling political leaders of France and Britain. Little worms, he would shortly call them on a historic occasion when he again humbled the two Western democracies with the greatest of ease. Neither Great Britain and France, their governments and their peoples, nor the majority of the German people seemed to realize, as 1937 began, that almost all that Hitler had done in his first 4 years was a preparation for war. This writer can testify from personal observation that right up to September 1, 1939, the German people were convinced that Hitler would get what he wanted, and what they wanted, without recourse to war. But among the elite who were running Germany, or serving it in the key positions, there could have been no doubt what Hitler's objective was. As the 4-year trial period of Nazi rule, as Hitler called it, approached an end, Goering, who in September 1936 had been put in charge of the 4-year plan, bluntly stated what was coming in a secret speech to industrialists and high officials in Berlin. "The battle we are now approaching," he said, "demands a colossal measure of production capacity. No limit on rearmament can be visualized. The only alternatives are victory or destruction. We live in a time when the final battle is in sight. We are already on the threshold of mobilization, and we are already at war. All that is lacking is the actual shooting." Goering's warning was given on December 17, 1936. Within 11 months, as we shall shortly see, Hitler made his fateful and inalterable decision to go to war. 1937. No surprises. In his address to the robots of the Reichstag on January 30, 1937, Hitler proclaimed, "The time of so-called surprises has been ended." And, in truth, there were no weekend surprises during 1937. Wilhelmstrasse officials used to say jokingly that Hitler pulled his surprises on Saturdays because he had been told that British officials took the weekend off in the country. The year for Germany was one of consolidation and further preparation for the objectives which in November the Führer would at last lay down to a handful of his highest officers. It was a year devoted to forging armaments, training troops, trying out the new air force in Spain, developing ersatz gasoline and rubber, cementing the Rome-Berlin axis, and watching for further weak spots in Paris, London, and Vienna. In his testimony at Nuremberg on March 14, 1946, Goering spoke proudly of the opportunities which the Spanish Civil War gave for testing my young Luftwaffe. With the permission of the Führer, I sent a large part of my transport fleet and a number of my experimental fighter units, bombers and anti-aircraft guns, and in that way I had an opportunity to ascertain, under combat conditions, whether the material was equal to the task. In order that the personnel, too, might gather a certain experience, I saw to it that there was a continuous flow, so that new people were constantly being sent and others recalled. All through the first months of 1937, Hitler sent important emissaries to Rome to cultivate Mussolini. The Germans were somewhat uneasy over Italy's flirtation with Britain. On January 2nd, Ciano had signed a gentleman's agreement with the British government, in which the two countries recognized each other's vital interests in the Mediterranean, and they realized that the question of Austria was still a touchy subject in Rome. When Goering saw the Duce on January 15th and bluntly spoke of the inevitability of the Anschluss with Austria, the excitable Italian dictator, according to the German interpreter Paul Schmidt, shook his head violently, and Ambassador von Hassel reported to Berlin that Goering's statement on Austria had met with a cool reception. In June, Neurath hastened to assure the Duce that Germany would abide by its July 11th pact with Austria. Only in the case of an attempted restoration of the Habsburgs would the Germans take stern action. Thus placated on Austria and still smarting from the opposition of France and Britain to almost all of his ambitions, in Ethiopia, in Spain, in the Mediterranean, Mussolini accepted an invitation from Hitler to visit Germany. And on September 25, 1937, outfitted in a new uniform created especially for the occasion, he crossed the Alps into the Third Reich. Feted and flattered as a conquering hero by Hitler and his aides, Mussolini could not then know how fateful a journey this was, the first of many to Hitler's side, which were to lead to a progressive weakening of his own position, and finally to a disastrous end. Hitler's purpose was not to engage in further diplomatic conversations with his guest, but to impress him with Germany's strength, and thus play on Mussolini's obsession to cast his lot with the winning side. The Duce was rushed from one side of Germany to the other, to parades of the SS and the troops, to army maneuvers in Mecklenburg, to the roaring armament factories in the Ruhr. His visit was climaxed by a celebration in Berlin on September 28th, which visibly impressed him. A gigantic crowd of 1 million persons was gathered on the Maifeld to hear the two fascist dictators speak their pieces. Mussolini, orating in German, was carried away by the deafening applause and by Hitler's flattering words. The Duce, said the Führer, was one of those lonely men of the ages on whom history is not tested, but who themselves are the makers of history. I remember that a severe thunderstorm broke over the field before Mussolini had finished his oration, and that in the confusion of the scattering mob, the SS security arrangements broke down, and the proud Duce, drenched to the skin and sorely put, was forced to make his way back to his headquarters alone and as best he could. However, this untoward experience did not dampen Mussolini's enthusiasm to be a partner of this new, powerful Germany. And the next day, after reviewing a military parade of Army, Navy, and Air Force detachments, he returned to Rome convinced that his future lay at the side of Hitler. It was not surprising, then, that a month later, when Ribbentrop journeyed to Rome to obtain Mussolini's signature for the Anti-Comintern Pact, a ceremony held on November 6th, he was told by the Duce of Italy's declining interest in the independence of Austria. Let events in Austria take their natural course, Mussolini said. This was the go-ahead for which Hitler had been waiting. Another ruler became impressed by Nazi Germany's growing power when Hitler broke the Locarno Treaty and, in occupying the Rhineland, placed German troops on the Belgian border, King Leopold withdrew his country from the Locarno Pact and from its alliance with Britain and France, and proclaimed that henceforth Belgium would follow a strict course of neutrality. This was a serious blow to the collective defense of the West, but in April 1937, Britain and France accepted it, an action for which they, as well as Belgium, would soon pay dearly. At the end of May, the Wilhelmstrasse had watched with interest the retirement of Stanley Baldwin as Prime Minister of Great Britain and the accession of Neville Chamberlain to that post. The Germans were pleased to hear that the new British Prime Minister would take a more active part in foreign affairs than had his predecessor, and that he was determined to reach, if possible, an understanding with Nazi Germany. What sort of understanding would be acceptable to Hitler was outlined in a secret memorandum of November 10th, written by Baron von Weizsäcker, then head of the political department of the German Foreign Office. "From England, we want colonies and freedom of action in the East. The British need for tranquility is great. It would be profitable to find out what England would be willing to pay for such tranquility." An occasion for finding out what England would pay arose in November when Lord Halifax, with Mr. Chamberlain's enthusiastic approval, made the pilgrimage to Berchtesgaden to see Hitler. On November 19th, they held a long conversation, and in the lengthy secret German memorandum on it drawn up by the German Foreign Office, 3 points emerge. Chamberlain was most anxious for a settlement with Germany and proposed talks between the two countries on a cabinet level. Britain wanted a general European settlement, in return for which she was prepared to make concessions to Hitler as regards colonies and Eastern Europe. Hitler was not greatly interested at the moment in an Anglo-German accord. In view of the rather negative outcome of the talk, it was surprising to the Germans that the British seemed to be encouraged by it. Chamberlain wrote in his diary, "The German visit of Halifax was, from my point of view, a great success, because it achieved its object, that of creating an atmosphere in which it is possible to discuss with Germany the practical questions involved in a European settlement." Keith Feiling, The Life of Neville Chamberlain, page 332. Halifax himself seems to have been taken in by Hitler. In a written report to the Foreign Office, he said, "The German Chancellor and others gave the impression that they were not likely to embark on adventures involving force, or at least war." To Chamberlain, Halifax reported orally, says Charles C. Tansel, that Hitler was not bent on early adventures, partly because they might be unprofitable, and partly because he was busy building up Germany internally. Goering had assured him that not one drop of German blood would be shed in Europe unless Germany was absolutely forced to do it. The Germans gave him, Halifax, the impression of intending to achieve their aims in orderly fashion. Tansel, Backdoor to War, pages 365-66. It would have been a much greater surprise to the British government had it known of a highly secret meeting which Hitler had held in Berlin with his military chiefs and his foreign minister exactly 14 days before his conversation with Lord Halifax. The fateful decision of November 5th, 1937. An indication of things to come and of the preparations that must be made to meet them had been given the commanders-in-chief of the three armed forces on June 24, 1937, by Field Marshal von Blomberg in a directive marked Top Secret, of which only 4 copies were made. The general political situation, the Minister of War and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces informed the 3 service chiefs, justifies the supposition that Germany need not consider an attack from any side. Neither the Western powers nor Russia, he said, had any desire for war, nor were they prepared for it. Nevertheless, the directive continued, the politically fluid world situation, which does not preclude surprising incidents, demands constant preparedness for war on the part of the German armed forces to make possible the military exploitation of politically favorable opportunities should they occur. Preparations of the armed forces for a possible war in the mobilization period 1937-38 must be made with this in mind. What possible war, since Germany need not fear an attack from any side? Blomberg was quite specific. There were 2 eventualities for war, Kriegsfalle, for which plans are being drafted. 1. war on two fronts with the main struggle in the West, strategic concentration, Rut. 2. War on two fronts with the main struggle in the Southeast, strategic concentration, Grün. The assumption in the first case was that the French might stage a surprise attack on Germany, in which case the Germans would employ their main forces in the West. This operation was given the code name Red, Rut. This is the first of many such code names for German military plans which we shall meet in the ensuing narrative. The Germans used the word Fall, literally case, Fall Rut, Fall Grün, case Red, case Green, the code names for operations in the West and against Czechoslovakia, respectively. And in the beginning, according to the arguments of the German generals in Nuremberg, it was merely the designation commonly used by all military commands for plans to cover hypothetical situations. But as will become obvious in the course of these pages, the term, as the Germans used it, soon became a designation for a plan of armed aggression. The word operation would probably be a more accurate rendering of Fall than the word case. However, for the sake of convenience, the author will go along with the word case. For the second eventuality, the war in the East can begin with a surprise German operation against Czechoslovakia in order to parry the imminent attack of a superior enemy coalition. The necessary conditions to justify such an action politically and in the eyes of international law must be created beforehand. Czechoslovakia, the directive stressed, must be eliminated from the very beginning and occupied. There were also three cases where special preparations were to be made. 1. Armed intervention against Austria, special case Otto. 2. Warlike complications with Red Spain, special case Ricard. 3. England, Poland, Lithuania take part in a war against us, extension of Red-Green. Case Otto is a code name that will appear with some frequency in these pages. Otto stood for Otto of Habsburg, the young pretender to the Austrian throne, then living in Belgium. In Blomberg's June directive, Case Otto was summarized as follows. The object of this operation, armed intervention in Austria in the event of her restoring the monarchy, will be to compel Austria by armed force to give up a restoration. Making use of the domestic political dissension of the Austrian people, there will be a march to this end in the general direction of Vienna, and any resistance will be broken. A note of caution, almost of despair, creeps into this revealing document at the end. There are no illusions about Britain. England, it warns, will employ all her available economic and military resources against us. Should she join Poland and Lithuania, the directive acknowledges, our military position would be worsened to an unbearable, even hopeless, extent. The political leaders will therefore do everything to keep these countries neutral, above all England. Although the directive was signed by Blomberg, it is obvious that it came from his master in the Reich Chancellery. To that nerve center of the Third Reich in the Wilhelmstrasse in Berlin, there came on the afternoon of November 5, 1937, to receive further elucidation from the Führer, six individuals: Field Marshal von Blomberg, Minister of War and Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, Colonel General Baron von Fritsch, Commander-in-Chief of the Army, Admiral Dr. Raeder, Commander-in-Chief of the Navy, Colonel General Goering, Commander-in-Chief of the Air Force, Baron von Neurath, Foreign Minister, and Colonel Hosbach, Military Adjutant to the Führer. Hosbach is not a familiar name in these pages, nor will it become one, but in the darkening hours of that November day, the young colonel played an important role. He took notes of what Hitler said, and 5 days later wrote them up in a highly secret memorandum, thus recording for history, his account showed up at Nuremberg among the captured documents, the decisive turning point in the life of the Third Reich. The meeting began at 4:15 p.m. and lasted until 8:30, with Hitler doing most of the talking. What he had to say, he began, was the fruit of thorough deliberation and the experiences of 4.5 years of power. He explained that he regarded the remarks he was about to make as of such importance that, in the event of his death, they should be regarded as his last will and testament. The aim of German policy, he said, was to make secure and to preserve the racial community and to enlarge it. It was therefore a question of space, Lebensraum. The Germans, he laid it down, had the right to a greater living space than other peoples. Germany's future was therefore wholly conditional upon the solving of the need for space. Where? Not in some far-off African or Asian colonies, but in the heart of Europe, in immediate proximity to the Reich. The question for Germany was, where could she achieve the greatest gain at the lowest cost? The history of all ages, the Roman Empire and the British Empire, had proved that expansion could only be carried out by breaking down resistance and taking risks. Setbacks were inevitable. There had never been spaces without a master, and there were none today. The attacker always comes up against a possessor. Two hate-inspired countries, Hitler declared, stood in Germany's way, Britain and France. Both countries were opposed to any further strengthening of Germany's position. The Führer did not believe that the British Empire was unshakable. In fact, he saw many weaknesses in it, and he proceeded to elaborate them. The troubles with Ireland and India, the rivalry with Japan in the Far East and with Italy and the Mediterranean. France's position, he thought, was more favorable than that of Britain, but France was going to be confronted with internal political difficulties. Nonetheless, Britain, France, and Russia must be considered as power factors in our political calculations. Therefore, Germany's problem could be solved only by means of force, and this was never without attendant risk. If one accepts as the basis of the following exposition the resort to force, with its attendant risks, then there remain to be answered the questions when and where. There were three cases to be dealt with. Case 1, period 1943-45. After this date, only a change for the worse, from our point of view, could be expected. The equipment of the Army, Navy, and Air Force was nearly completed. Equipment and armament were modern. In further delay, there lay the danger of their obsolescence. In particular, the secrecy of special weapons could not be preserved forever. Our relative strength would decrease in relation to the rearmament by the rest of the world. Besides, the world was expecting our attack and was increasing its countermeasures from year to year. It was while the rest of the world was increasing its defenses that we were obliged to take the offensive. Nobody knew today what the situation would be in the years 1943-45. One thing only was certain, that we could not wait longer. If the Führer was still living, it was his unalterable resolve to solve Germany's problem of space at the latest by 1943-45. The necessity for action before 1943-45 would arise in cases 2 and 3. Case 2. If internal strife in France should develop into such a domestic crisis as to absorb the French army completely and render it incapable of use for war against Germany, then the time for action against the Czechs had come. Case 3. If France is so embroiled by a war with another state that she cannot proceed against Germany, our first objective must be to overthrow Czechoslovakia and Austria simultaneously in order to remove the threat to our flank in any possible operation against the West. If the Czechs were overthrown and a common German-Hungarian frontier achieved, a neutral attitude on the part of Poland could be the more certainly counted upon in the event of a Franco-German conflict. But what would France, Britain, Italy, and Russia do? Hitler went into the answer to that question in considerable detail. He believed that almost certainly Britain and probably France had already tacitly written off the Czechs. Difficulties connected with the Empire and the prospect of being once more entangled in a protracted European war were decisive considerations for Britain against participation in a war against Germany. Britain's attitude would certainly not be without influence on that of France. An attack by France without British support, and with the prospect of the offensive being brought to a standstill on our western fortifications, was hardly probable. Nor was a French march through Belgium and Holland without British support to be expected. It would, of course, be necessary to maintain a strong defense on our western frontier during the prosecution of our attack on the Czechs and Austria. Hitler then outlined some of the advantages of the annexation of Czechoslovakia and Austria. Better strategic frontiers for Germany, the freeing of military forces for other purposes, acquisition of some 12 million Germans, additional foodstuffs for 5 to 6 million Germans in the Reich, and manpower for 12 new army divisions. He had forgotten to mention what Italy and Russia might do, and he now returned to them. He doubted whether the Soviet Union would intervene in view of Japan's attitude. Italy would not object to the elimination of the Czechs, but it was still a question as to her attitude if Austria was also taken. It depended essentially on whether the Duce were still alive. Hitler's supposition for Case 3 was that France would become embroiled in a war with Italy, a conflict that he counted upon. That was the reason, he explained, for his policy in trying to prolong the Spanish Civil War. It kept Italy embroiled with France and Britain. He saw a war between them coming definitely nearer. In fact, he said he was resolved to take advantage of it whenever it happened, even as early as 1938, which was just 2 months away. He was certain that Italy, with a little German help in raw materials, could stand off Britain and France. If Germany made use of this war to settle the Czech and Austrian questions, it was to be assumed that Britain, herself at war with Italy, would decide not to act against Germany. Without British support, a warlike action by France against Germany was not to be expected. The time for our attack on the Czechs and Austria must be made dependent on the course of the Anglo-French-Italian War. This favorable situation would not occur again. The descent upon the Czechs would have to be carried out with lightning speed. Thus, as evening darkened Berlin on that autumn day of November 5, 1937, the meeting broke up at 8:15, the die was cast. Hitler had communicated his irrevocable decision to go to war. To the handful of men who would have to direct it, there could no longer be any doubt. The dictator had said it all 10 years before in Mein Kampf, had said that Germany must have Lebensraum in the East and must be prepared to use force to obtain it. But then he had only been an obscure agitator, and his book, as Field Marshal von Blomberg later said, had been regarded by the soldiers, as by so many others, as a piece of propaganda whose large circulation was due to forced sales. But now the Wehrmacht chiefs and the foreign minister were confronted with specific dates for actual aggression against two neighboring countries, an action which they were sure would bring on a European war. They must be ready by the following year, 1938, and at the latest by 1943-45. The realization stunned them. Not, so far as the Hossbach records show, because they were struck down by the immorality of their leaders' proposals, but for more practical reasons. Germany was not ready for a big war. To provoke one now would risk disaster. On those grounds, Blomberg, Fritsch, and Neurath dared to speak up and question the Führer's pronouncement. Within 3 months, all of the three were out of office, and Hitler, relieved of their opposition, such as it was, and it was the last he was to suffer in his presence during the Third Reich, set out on the road of the conqueror to fulfill his destiny. In the beginning, it was an easier road than he, or anyone else, had foreseen.